This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2018 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. I'm Chris Moore. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Funding for Festival Showcase is provided by the Barnard Fain Foundation. Today, we talk with pianist Orly Shaham, but first, Nicholas McGeegan, who conducts the Baroque Evening Concert July 12th with violinist Simone Porter. Well, as I'm sure you all know, we pre-record our shows, and Nicholas McGeegan walked in with a smile at 8 o'clock in the morning, so you must have pumped yourself with lots of caffeine to make this interview possible.
A little bit, and also I'm one of the few that actually comes east to go to Aspen, so it's even earlier in the morning for me.
Oh my goodness, that's really cool.
I flew
cool
in from
me.
California yesterday, so...
Thank you so much for coming in, especially at this bizarre hour. I guess you're going to a rehearsal after this, too.
Absolutely. So this is just a warm-up.
Uh-huh. Okay. The big concert that I know people who actually literally drive all the way to Aspen from Denver or Grand Junction or whatever just to hear your concert. That's the only thing they do, to hear the Baroque Evening. I wonder with Baroque music, because it was obviously the golden era of patronage, and everybody, if you were anybody, you had to have your own court orchestra and everything else like that. How did that affect the kind of sound of the music and the character of the music of the Baroque versus other eras?
Well, I think certainly for the people who had courts, that was all over Germany, and then little ones, Italy, little dukes and princes everywhere, I say relatively little, Russia too, let's not forget.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got the capitals, you've got Paris and London, where music was done in a much bigger format. The Paris Opera was a huge institution with a vast orchestra. Handel could put on the water music, or the fireworks music, let me say, with 26 oboes or something. I mean, occasionally you could get together for something big. But generally speaking, they didn't have concert halls in the 18th century like we have. They didn't have places that would hold 1,500, 2,000 people, partly because they couldn't light them. In the evenings, you can't... How many candles do you have to burn?
Yes, I hadn't
thought
about that.
So orchestral music was done either in a theater, sometimes in a church, but rarely, or it was done in rich people's houses. And the whole point of being a very, very rich person is you want to keep people out, not invite them in. Mm-hmm. The more people you invite, the less exclusive it is.
Right.
So if it's an audience of two and you happen to be the prince and princess of somewhere... That's just fine.
Uh-huh.
It's your orchestra, after all. They came through the servants' entrance.
There's less of a personal quality to Baroque music in this, when you compare it to, say, the Romantics, who were very individualistic. And I'm wondering if the fact that you were serving a prince or the church may have had an impact on that, too.
Who knows? Certainly your job is to please the person who pays you.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that's changed very much over the years.
Right.
I think that certainly in the 19th century, artists suddenly decided that they were personally interesting and therefore flaunted their personalities. But that, in the case of someone like Liszt as a pianist, that's not so different from somebody like Vivaldi as a violinist, who was known as this glorious virtuoso. The difference is that they didn't write about it.
Mm-hmm.
The first great letters by composers are people like Mozart. They're much later in the 18th century. Then all the letters from Bach are basically about people not paying him.
Right.
I saw
some of those.
If you had, obviously they had great emotions, but they saw everybody. They went round the corner. They didn't need to write.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when people traveled vastly that they needed to write, which is why Haydn didn't start writing many letters until he came to London. He wrote letters, but they're mostly to his publisher, saying, you didn't pay me enough. He saw everybody else.
But when I read the stories of these Baroque composers, they're no less colorful. My goodness. I know for you, you have Vivaldi, who you mentioned, Rameau, Leclerc, who I guess was murdered.
Leclerc was actually murdered as a result maybe of some hanky-panky with somebody else's wife.
Oh,
yes.
Okay. So these are not what you would call boring people.
Nor are they cold-blooded, it appears.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, they were tremendous characters. I mean, it was said of Rameau that he was only kind to anyone by mistake. And he didn't start writing music till he was 50, by which time most people were dead.
Mm-hmm.
He was a cranky old cuss, I think you could say. It comes across in his music, not the difficultness, but just a very individual person indeed. We know that Handel was a very passionate, perhaps sometimes very depressed mm-hmm. character. We know that Vivaldi, well, he said Mass, but very rarely. Mm-hmm. He was a priest in name only, shall we say.
He got in trouble for that, too, I think.
Oh, yes. Well, even in Italy.
Didn't he just walk off and just start composing in the middle of serving a Mass or something like that?
Yeah, he claimed that he had such bad asthma he couldn't say Mass.
Oh, okay.
Nice try, Antonio.
Nice excuse.
Yeah. But, right. You know, they were all very passionate people, and I feel that you can hear that in their music. Mm-hmm. Just because there's what you might call a surface elegance is no different from the fact that a gentleman in those days wore a white wig and lots of gold all over his clothes. That made him look good, but it didn't make him any less passionate. And I think the mm-hmm. danger is that sometimes with Baroque music, we're sort of stuck on the elegance of it all and slightly downplay the passion.
Mm-hmm.
An audience in those days would have found any Vivaldi concerto full of risks. In a concerto written in 1710, the whole form of a concerto is only about 25 years old. It's very new. We think of Vivaldi violin concertos as having been, you know, an old form. But it is now, but it wasn't then.
Mm-hmm.
People, Vivaldi showed off like crazy. He's playing higher, faster than anybody else could at the time. He was the Iggy Pop of his day.
You have two French composers on our list here of works that you're going to be playing on July 12th. Can you tell us a little bit about the politics of the French musical scene, especially in the king's courts?
Yeah, well, the French court was a vast bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the kings chose to live in Versailles, which is about 20 miles outside Paris. And in Rameau's day, there was only a temporary opera house. The opera house that's there now wasn't built till 1766, which is 2 years after both Leclerc and Rameau died.
Mm-hmm.
Rameau was born in 1683, so he was 81 when he died, and still composing hard. Leclerc, as we mentioned earlier, was murdered and found in a doorway. But they both worked for what was essentially a branch of government. France regarded itself as the principal nation of Europe, the leader of Europe in every possible way. It was certainly the biggest and most populous country, because Germany was a whole series of little principalities, Italy the same. Russia was bigger, but Paris was definitely centralized. The Paris Opera was the biggest musical and cultural institution there was. So to write an opera for it was a government commission, in mm-hmm. effect. Leclerc only wrote one. Rameau wrote quite a few. He had sort of a lock on the officialdom there. Mm-hmm. And it was vast chorus, an orchestra of over 60. A big building and very palatial. So the operas were very grand. Basically, every time a singer came on stage, they had a new costume. Fantastic sets on stage. And luckily, some of them survive as models. So we can see just how fancy and elaborate they were. We think of opera as something, particularly Baroque opera, as something that you listen to on a CD.
Mm-hmm.
For them, listening to it was only part of the experience. There was the poetry, which was often very good. There was the set, as I mentioned, very elaborate, and there was tons and tons of dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And dancing, was said of the French that they were so besotted that with dance that if the Last Judgment could have been set as a ballet, they would have done it. And it's a tradition that continues right into the 19th century and the 20th century with the Ballet Russe and so on. The French, particularly the Parisians, love ballet. And that's an old tradition dating back to Lully, who and Louis XIV, both of whom danced.
Weren't Rameau's works called opera ballets, not even just operas?
Yes, there were serious operas. They're called tragédies lyriques. They actually have stories. They don't end tragically. They usually end with somebody getting married or somebody who was supposed to be killed being rescued. But then they had much lighter forms, particularly the comedy ballet and the opéra ballet, which have stories. But not every act is the same story. Sometimes the story is a theme, and then each act is a different play on that theme.
Mm-hmm.
There's one called The Temple of Glory, for example, which Rameau wrote with Voltaire, in which each act is about what makes a good king,
mm-hmm.
which was aimed squarely at Louis XIV,
Louis. Right.
Who wasn't too pleased.
Uh-huh.
Les Indes Galantes, the Gallant Indies, is all about different nations of the world being nice to each other. So we have the Huron Indians at the end of the opera, we have the Turks, we have Persians, and as I say, the Incas of Peru. So you have the Old World and the New World. And basically it shows that people can be the noble savage. Not only the French have a lock on politeness
mm-hmm.
and good behavior and knowing how to treat people well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the moral of the piece. And of course it allows the composer and the set designer and the costume designer and the ballet to have that dancing that gives the flavor of the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire. And let's be quite clear, ladies, 18th century French ladies, loved the Turkish Empire because it meant in costume they didn't have to wear corsets and heavy wigs. They could swan around in diaphanous silks, so they liked that a lot. The men, of course, liked it because they thought they could have more than one wife.
Right.
And so then you have the Turks, equally exotic, the Incas, very exotic, and the Huron Indians, wonderful costumes. And one of the most famous pieces in Les Ingalantes, which we're doing, is the Dance of the Great Peace Pipe. And actually, some real Huron Indians did come to Paris in the 1720s and danced on the stage. Mm-hmm. And Rameau wrote this piece for them.
Oh,
then he incorporated it into this ballet because it was very popular.
And that's some of the music we'll be hearing.
Absolutely. We have some music by the Incas, from supposedly the Incas worshipping the sun. And we have the Dance of the Great Peace Pipe.
Oh, my goodness. We have to bring a peace pipe along.
Yeah. So the program has a sort of a theme, Le Monde Galant, the gallant world, if you like. Mm-hmm. It's how the French, and this the theme of the whole Aspen Festival this year is Paris. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at how in the 18th century the French viewed other parts of the world. We even have, from a different Rameau opera, we have a little bit of China. We have Les Pagodes and the Entrée des Chinois. We also have, in the first part, we have some Leclerc who's looking at Sicily. We have also Gluck having a go at Spain, mm-hmm. with a few castanets in the background. And sort of dropped into this, we have my good friend Simone Porter playing two Vivaldi concertos just for the hell of it, because right. She's fabulous.
Yes, indeed. And it's funny because I think of the Vivaldi concerti. Gosh, what did you write? Something like 100 violin concerti or something like that?
Oh, many more.
Oh,
about 500 total, I think. Not
concerti.
Just for concerti. Yeah,
yes.
Oh, the Vivaldi's violin concertos are the biggest number. I haven't ever counted them. I'm not sure he did either.
Hundreds or so.
Yes.
Yes. But they were often written for the young women, for the orphans, right?
Yes.
They were written for teenagers sometimes.
And it's actually a much sadder story than you think, because the girls, when they were hit 18, were summarily kicked out of the orphanage. They had to give their violin back, and they, women instrumentalists could have no career.
Mm-hmm.
Women singers were all right. So, you know, you could play a Vivaldi violin concerto, hit your 18th birthday, you're out. You'll probably become a cleaning lady. You might be picked up by some rich old Venetian who simply marries you or takes you. There's no career involved in that. The only career you could possibly have are one that is unmentionable, and the other was probably being a seamstress.
Oh, my goodness. This is news to me. I'm so sad.
There was a very sad play by Don Taylor, late lamented BBC producer and writer, on one of Vivaldi's girls to whom this happened, because it happened to all of them, and having to give up her violin knowing that she'd never be able to play it again in public.
During the concerts, Vivaldi used to have a curtain in front of everybody so that you wouldn't be just lusting after the girls, you would just be hearing the music.
It's still there. If you go to the Pietà now, they'll charge you money to see Vivaldi's church. Well, don't pay it, because it isn't. That church was built just after Vivaldi died.
Mm-hmm.
There are four columns left of, basically, of the building of the Pietà from Vivaldi's day, which were from the church, and they are in the bar of the Hotel Metropole, which is next door.
Okay,
and it's well worth visiting that, because that is where Thomas Mann lived while he was writing Death in Venice, and Freud also stayed there.
Pay
money for that, for a really good Negroni, but don't, pay, for heaven's sake, pay the Pietà to see a church that wasn't there in Vivaldi's day.
Right.
It was next door. But what you can see are the equivalent of Vivaldi's grills, so that the music could come out, but people could not see in. They're also high up. But there is an interesting thing. I think it's from the philosopher Rousseau, who imagined these angelic creatures behind the grill. Anyway, being a Frenchman, of course, he went to have a look. And he was woefully disappointed.
Oh,
there was Bianca the bassoon, who was as big as a hippo, and all the rest of it. He was imagining them all sprouting wings and playing, but they were just perfectly ordinary people. They just sounded like angels. Mm-hmm. But I like the idea that you could only listen to the music because it was too stimulating if you actually saw them play. I think that could be something we could revive. We'll all play behind grills.
Right. Well, speaking of rules of etiquette like that, I get the very distinct impression that some of the traditional rules of classical music etiquette are not really for you. Maybe we could have a Nicholas McGeegan ideas for what is actually what you consider to be behavior that you enjoy seeing in an audience when you're conducting.
Well, of course, I don't get to see them.
I'm
facing
the
wrong
way.
You
get to hear them. You get to hear their cell phones.
Oh, you get to hear the cell phones. Yeah, my feeling about that is if you don't know how to turn it off, don't turn it on.
Right.
The cell phone.
Don't bring it in.
Don't bring it in. In other countries than this one, they have a sort of an electronic shell over the hall, which means that they all are automatically switched off when you're going in. And if you're a doctor or something, you have to leave it outside. I think that some concert etiquette is not suitable for Baroque music. One is the audiences in the 18th century clapped when they felt like it.
Mm-hmm.
They clapped certainly between movements, and we know that they clapped during movements.
If there was a really great solo or something
like that.
Not
only that.
Like a jazz show.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, last week I did the Paris Symphony on a concert, and Mozart wrote a letter about it saying, I put a bit in there that I knew the Paris audience would like, and they applauded, so I knew they did.
Mm-hmm.
So Mozart isn't saying, oh, the audience made a noise.
Right.
It was
right.
That they showed their appreciation. They also made a noise all the way through the beginning of the last movement, which was one of the first pieces in France as a last movement ever to begin softly. And they talked all the way through it. And then they realized they'd missed the first 16 bars. They clapped.
Uh-huh.
So they were right there. And I'd certainly like in some Beethoven symphonies for the audience to start clapping about 20 bars before the end, because that's the idea. You've got all this bashing away on
right.
it. Of course, it's to whip the audience up into a frenzy.
Like the 1-5-1-5-1
yes,
the
yes.
Beethoven's fifth.
So that they
yeah.
absolutely maybe even clap in the wrong place. That's fine. But I think that sort of super politeness in a concert. I remember going years ago with a friend of mine who brought his sort of 10-year-old kid, and there was a song, mm-hmm. and she started to laugh. And someone, because it was very funny, mm-hmm. and someone turned to her and said, be quiet, it's a concert. And she said, oh, I'm sorry, but it's funny. If it's funny, laugh.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you like it, you don't have to sit there like a bunch of Swiss bankers. Now, I have heard, and I heard this from a very good source, that people come to Aspen precisely because they don't feel they have to have been to the dry cleaners in order mm-hmm. to show up at a concert.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to wear the perfect suit. You can show up in shorts. You can show mm-hmm. up in jeans. You
and,
can
and
show
be
up
a billionaire. Both
and
be, of those
and,
things.
Well, the person about whom, the person who said that actually was.
Right.
And didn't so much enjoy going to the San Francisco Symphony because he had felt he had to dress up, but loved coming to Aspen because just show up.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you've got, of course, one of the smartest audiences in the world here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Nobel Prize winners practically outnumber the players.
Oh, I know.
At certain concerts. I mean, that's fantastic.
Uh-huh.
And also the most exciting thing, of course, is that you've got an audience of not only the billionaires, the millionaires, music lovers, but also all these fabulous students.
Mm-hmm.
And hundreds of them. So you've got from 50, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, up to 90. And that's what you really want. People say classical music is now the branch of Social Security.
Right.
In some ways. You come here and you know it's not.
No.
This is how it will be.
Right.
And will continue to be. And not only in Aspen, but dare one mention Tanglewood, Music Academy of the West, Marlborough, mm-hmm. all these places where the students come in the summer. And there are similar ones happening in other countries. It's
well,
fantastic.
The students give me hope that there is a future for our music.
Absolutely. Okay. All we have to do now is to get them to run the government.
Right, exactly. We look forward to seeing you on the 12th. I hope you continue to come back to Aspen year after year.
So do I. I love it. Thanks very much, Chris.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase, and we've been talking with conductor Nicholas McGeegan, who conducts an all-Baroque evening July 12th with violinist Simon Porter in the music of Vivaldi, Leclerc, and Rameau. Next up, on July 14th, don't miss the Orly Shaham piano recital. She's invited several of her colleagues to join her in performances of Stravinsky, Bach, Ravel, Schoenfeld, and especially Steve Reich. Orly, one thing that's unique about your program that's coming up here in Aspen is that Steve Reich begins and ends the program. Can we start by saying a little bit about him and why you obviously like him as a composer quite a bit?
I've loved much of his music. I've taught his music to music literature students. It's such an important part of what it means to be a 21st century musician, to understand the trajectory that he's gone through. And this quartet was actually a really recent piece. It was written in 2014, and it's for two pianos and two vibraphones. And I just loved it from the first second that I heard it. There's something about the quality of the sounds in it that I feel like he's taken all the elements that he's worked on his whole life and distilled them into this perfectly joyful, beautiful 14-minute piece that is exuberant and lovely and quite delicious and very, very difficult to play.
Yes, I have actually heard it live, and you're right, it's very joyful. Tehillim is another one. It's a choral work, very different, but also very joyful. And I remember in the early 70s, his music was really intense and painful to listen to. In fact, somebody called the cops on me when I played some of his music on the radio back in the early 1980s. And Steve Reich was very amused when he found out about that, that it actually made national news.
That's great.
But do you know, in a sense, what has happened to him that has moved his trajectory of expression?
You know, I think this happens to a lot of composers, right? They play around with a lot of ideas throughout their lives, and they never really end up rejecting any of those ideas. They just sort of move on and think about other things, and then at some point things get distilled to their bare essences. I think of Bartok and his third piano concerto, which to me takes everything, it's so different from the first two, and it takes everything that he'd been working on before and just sort of gets the purest form of it. I feel like that's a lot what quartet is about. And in fact, the whole program is structured to show those different threads that had been on Steve Reich's mind throughout his life and lead into the quartet. So we start with Piano Phase, which is, that's a very different kind of a listen. It's absolutely a minimalist piece with very limited musical material that works itself out incredibly slowly over time, puts you in a completely different space. I mean, here we are in Colorado, legal marijuana. I'm just saying, maybe there's...
I'm being a suggestion here.
Just saying. But that's Piano Phase, which I'll be playing with a wonderful young pianist, Micah McLaurin. Over the course of about 15 minutes, we will use the same tiny little bit of material and just look at it from every side. I think it's a lot like a kaleidoscope. You know, you just have a few little figures, but every time you turn them, suddenly it makes a completely different feeling, completely different sense of the world around you. So that starts the program off. We're following that with Stravinsky's Septet, so we go from, you know, just pianos to seven different instruments, a much bigger orchestration, but it's a very compact piece. It's a very much a neo-Baroque piece of music where you can really hear the individual lines in counterpoint.
And is that with strings and winds?
It is. It is. It's a mixed bag, quite literally. One of the reasons I put this kind of program together for Aspen is there's so many wonderful colleagues of mine here that I love to collaborate with, from the faculty who are teaching here all summer to the guest artists who come for just a short while, and even to the students. We have a few students on the program as well. The Stravinsky will sort of show that linear side of Steve Reich's music. That, and in fact, he's a huge Stravinsky fan. This kind of a single horizontal line that you can follow that at the same time has other horizontal lines that you can follow all around it. Which leads us to the master of those, Bach.
Bach, yes. And now you chose a Bach-Liszt combination. I think that's because this was originally an organ work and Liszt had to figure out a way to bring the pedal up into your hands, right?
And to Liszt's credit, he did next to nothing to it. He pretty much left it as is, except a couple of added octaves.
That is so unusual for Liszt.
Maybe that's why I love this one so much. This was a piece that I first learned as a student here at the Aspen Music Festival. I hesitate to say this, but it's closing in on 30 years ago. And I just fell in love with it then. Really, I could have, for the purpose of attuning our ears to Steve Reich's listening, I really could have picked almost any Prelude and Fugue by Bach. But this particular one is so powerful and so heartfelt. Maybe it's the Liszt tinge in it that you do feel it's slightly more romantic than some of the others. It's enormously satisfying. It has one of those perfect Baroque Bachian fugue themes that is sort of symmetrical in every turn and yet ornamented, and you know, it's like a case study in Baroque style.
In the second half, you have Ravel, you have the Hebraic melodies, Now, Ravel was not Jewish, I don't believe,
no.
Correct? Do you know the story? Because I know the piece, but I don't know the story of why he chose this. It's a wonderful work. I love it.
Stunningly beautiful. So this, on the second half, we sort of turn to Steve Reich's Jewish side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Ravel picked a lot of ethnic music for many different kinds. I'm not sure what exactly is the story behind having picked these two chants, but I know that he didn't take them literally. The first one, the Kaddish, it's a real prayer. Although he takes the words, he sets it slightly differently and a very Ravelian style, a way of sort of mysticism and feeling very mystical kind of piece. You know, I think it's very spiritual, and Ravel is really putting it in a place. It's a setting.
Mm-hmm.
It's, again, a very deep spiritual place that I think Steve Reich identifies with as a person. He's a very, very deeply spiritual Jewish man. Mm-hmm. So even though Ravel doesn't have the Jewish part, I think he really does get at that spiritual, divine, something bigger than us. Mm-hmm. And of course, the second song about the eternal enigma, he kind of laughs off. The lyrics are tra-la-la-la-la. He sort of laughs off those deep questions about life. So the first song is very much about those deep questions and about death and those giant things. And the second one says, well, you know, but we're here for now, so let's sort of be joyful, which I think is very much something that leads into the music of Steve Reich as well.
Uh-huh. And then you have a clarinet trio, and of course, immediately I think of klezmer.
You're absolutely right. There's a whole lot of klezmer in this, just a little bit of mayonnaise and mostly klezmer. It's a great, great piece. This is Paul Schoenfield's clarinet trio. Schoenfield's an interesting composer. He doesn't think of himself as a major classical composer, uppercase letters, but he's a wonderful composer, and his cafe music for piano trio has really come into the repertoire. This trio for clarinet rather than the violin, it's filled with all sorts of Jewish themes, from Hasidic kind of melodies to more mournful dirges, to wedding dance, a Georgian sort of wedding dance, a lot of crazy rhythms, things that are just going to be a lot of fun to listen to. I can't stress this enough. This piece is so much fun to listen to. It's really a blast to play. The clarinetist gets to do a lot of those glissandi back and forth and, you know, shaking the notes until they get to that right pitch. Very free. And yet it's actually, as a piece, incredibly difficult and well worked out and very detailed. So although it ends up sounding totally free and just, I mean, exuberant is the word I keep coming back to, it's very carefully worked out by Paul, who was influenced quite a bit, not only by Hasidic and klezmer music, but also by the music of Bartok. You know, there's a famous trio, of course, Bartok's Contrasts, for the same setup. Mm-hmm. And you hear little quotations from that throughout as well.
One thing about Aspen is that I always find it, I know how busy musicians are here, the teaching, the all the obligations that happen, and yet it seems as though this is not uncommon up here for people to find colleagues to just have a blast with together. I would think that people would just say, I'm really sorry, really, I'm just so busy, I just can't even imagine being able to cram this into my schedule. How do you get them on board with you?
It's the altitude.
They feel like they can do anything.
Yeah, it makes you feel like you're all powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that there's something addictive about music making in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
The ability to just, you know, when you need that break from your, whatever you're working on, rather than looking at your wall, or as many of my fellow New Yorkers do, looking at the wall of the building next door.
Right.
You know, you go and look out at these aspen trees and these majestic pine trees and these incredible mountains, and you're totally refreshed to go back in and do some more practice.
Right. Well, Ollie, I hope you, your kids, your husband, your dachshund, everybody, has a great time in Aspen. Enjoy your vacation here, and we look forward to enjoying your performances.
Thank you so much.
We've been chatting with pianist Ollie Shaham, whose recital will be July 14th. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2018 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 for more interviews. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks for listening.